Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts delivering all the essential updates that you need fast and focused. It's Friday, the 20th of September, and on our program today, why government is not taking advantage of civil engineers in the private sector. Local astronomers join forces with NASA to learn more about Pluto. Are we entering a new era of accountability as a former public entity head is ordered to pay back millions? And beware of lengthy finance terms, says one financial expert. Now, as the country's water woes continue, the minister in the Department of Water and Sanitation, Pemi Majordina, says that the department doesn't have enough inspectors to ensure the safety standards of the country's 6,000 dams. Well, not so, says the civil rights organisation AfriForum, and it's called on the minister to collaborate with more than 5,000 certified civil engineers in the private sector who, I understand, are willing to help. Let me talk now to Marais de Waal, advisor for the environmental affairs issue or department and speaks for AfriForum. Marais, welcome and thank you very much indeed. When we talk about safety standards of the country's 6,000 dams, what exactly is the problem here?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and thanks for this chance to talk to you. The issue about these 6,000 dams that has to comply with safety standards is dams that are the specific criteria that they have a wall height of more than 5 meters and the capacity to store more than 50,000 cubic meters. So the risk, if these dams do not comply with the required standards, if there is a potentially big and catastrophic impact on the people living downstream of that dam, and that's what we've fairly recently seen in Malmesbury in the Western Cape, where there was an unusually high amount of rainfall, and it was a dam that did not comply with these standards, and it sort of caused the domino effect. One dam upstream collapsed, and three dams further down also collapsed, and it caused big infrastructural damage. Fortunately, no lives were lost, but it just put this issue of the shortage of inspectors in the limelight.
Right. So what specific skills then are needed to try and right-size the situation?
So currently, the type of dams that must be regularly inspected, the owner of a dam that complies with or that falls within this category of a dam with a safety risk must submit a report to the Department of Water and Sanitation once every 5 years as a minimum, and the department will evaluate that report. Based on the findings of the report, the dam will be classified whether it's in a good or a reasonable condition or if it's at the risk of failure, and then steps must be taken by the dam owner. But the problem is the department doesn't have the resources, the capacity, the personnel to conduct these inspections. They've only got there's only 100 registered professionals that can do these inspections, but as it stands, the department has a backlog of more than 500 inspections dating back from the 2018-2019 financial year.
All right. How do you know that these certified civil engineers are prepared to or are willing to help?
That is based on conversations we've had with the South African Institute for civil engineers specifically, and with them, they're abbreviated as SAICI. On their own books, they've got civil engineers in the country, which are specifically focused on the water sector. So it doesn't mean each and every of these 5,000 civil engineers are necessarily ready to meet all the requirements to become the inspectors that are needed by the Department of Water and Sanitation. But they've also had these conversations with the minister to say a process must be started to expedite the process of registering the qualified engineers.
Now, I know you don't speak for the Department of Water and Sanitation, but what reasons, to the best of your knowledge, are being given to demonstrate the reluctance? And I think we have lost Maria de Valde. I'll give it one moment to see if he's back. Yes, you're back with us. Fantastic. So let me put the question to you again. I know you don't speak for the Department of Water and Sanitation, but what reason, to the best of your knowledge, is being given by the department in terms of its reluctance to work with this cohort?
I would say the biggest thing that is budgetary constraints. So they simply can't go ahead with appointment of these professional persons,
which does sound fairly reasonable if they haven't got the money.
Of course, but that is further motivation why there should be further private sector involvement, because it's an issue that the department on its own won't be able to solve.
So, what does private sector involvement mean then?
Well, encouraging private registered civil engineers to register as inspectors and to have a less red tape in the process to have them become inspectors. That's the conversation that we would say needs to happen as soon as possible.
But it still comes down to money, doesn't it?
Well, there's always money, but there's also the other side of the coin is prioritizing how it should be used, because as it stands with 6,000 potential dams that are safety risks, the consequences of catastrophic failures are that much orders of magnitude bigger.
I understand that there are safety issues, but you use the word catastrophic. Is that really the case? Are you not over-amplifying or exaggerating this slightly?
Yes and no. Obviously, not all 6,000 of those dams are at the point of failure, but the fact that they are not being regularly inspected means it's an unknown. And if these inspections aren't taken, aren't conducted as they should be, then bit by bit, structures can become weakened up to the point of a catastrophic failure in reality. That is what has been in this Malmesbury incident.
All right, so you've waded into the debate as AfriForum. What are you doing in that respect in order to try and facilitate some sort of dialogue, if in fact that's what you're doing?
Exactly. We, as a civil rights watchdog, first of all, we just want the public to be aware of what the situation is, because your average reader doesn't necessarily read the reports to parliamentary portfolio committees and the like. So we're bringing the issue to the public debate, basically. And also, we have ongoing discussions with the Department of Water and Sanitation at various levels. But, for example, we've had, on other matters, constructive conversations with the Director General. So that's our role, to facilitate the debate.
So constructive conversation, but nothing's really happened.
Well, this is something that is not brand new, but the issue has only come to the fore within the last month. So nothing concrete has been set in motion. No.
All right. Well, thank you very much indeed. Obviously, it's an important story. We'll keep our finger on it. Maria de Val, Advisor for Environmental Affairs at AfriForum, I do appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move now from water to money. And even with a more positive inflation outlook and a repo rate cut of 25 basis points, cash-strapped consumers are still being offered extended loan terms on everything from home and vehicle finance to even cell phone contracts. But instant gratification may be leading to massive debt traps that will keep consumers paying for years. even after the shine of that new car has waned. Now, we spoke about this issue a little earlier in the week with ABSA. I want to give you another view now, because we do consider it important. And we're in conversation with financial journalist Maya Fisher-French. And Maya, firstly then, what do you think are the biggest risks that consumers are facing when opting for extended loan terms?
I think the problem we're facing is that we're committing too much of our future income to something that we've bought in the past. And one of the big things, Jeremy, I see is that people forget about the fact that one day their children are going to go to school, they're going to have school fees to pay, they're going to have university fees, and suddenly they're locked into these incredibly long-term commitments. You know, if you're buying a car over 6-7 years, you know, for the next 6-7 years, you have a commitment to pay back 10-12,000 rand a month, and you have no idea what other expenses and other things that you're going to have to face and deal with coming forward. So I think for me, it's locking you in to something going forward that, you know, that's going to have a huge impact on some of the other goals in your life. And I think that's the risk for me from a consumer perspective.
Do you think banks do enough to warn people of the dangers, or is it simply a debt trap in disguise, but there's obviously benefit as far as they're concerned because of interest?
I think that, you know, when I look at vehicle finance, for example, it is mostly sold through car dealerships. So I think that's one of the challenges, right? Now, you know, you can argue, Jeremy, like if there is a place for a 30-year mortgage. You know, if you're a young person struggling to get in the market, it makes it a little bit more affordable. And then as your income increases, so you can perhaps increase your repayments to that mortgage, you know, and actually effectively reduce it back to a 20-year mortgage. I can kind of see a place for that. I do not see a place for paying off a car over 72 months with a balloon payment, except that you are going to buy a car, a more expensive car, right? A car that you probably wouldn't normally be able to afford. And that is very much pushed to the dealerships. There is a huge, obviously, benefit to them to convince the consumer to buy a car on those terms. So, you know, I see it all the time. You walk into a dealership, you think, this is the car I can afford, but this is the car I want. And the dealer says, no, don't worry. The car you want, you can actually afford. We'll just push the payments out further. So I think a lot of that is happening at the point of sale, rather than perhaps at the bank level.
So it's just about our avarice sometimes and our gullibility. We've also got to be a little bit more careful as consumers, is what I think you're saying.
Absolutely. It comes down to you. We cannot blame everybody around us. I mean, if you walk into a car dealer, they are trying to sell you a car, and they're going to try and sell you the most expensive car they can. You can't blame them. That's actually their job. They've got their commissions they have to meet. You know, you have to walk in with some sort of sensibility around these things. And I do think we as consumers are quite quick to blame the banks and to blame everybody else around us, when actually they're giving us what we want. And maybe we need to start saying, well, you know, what is sensible and what commitments do I have going forward that are going to be more important to me than this more expensive car? I think we also need to catch a wake up and stop blaming everybody for our financial position.
But Maya, sometimes it does come down to personal cash flow management. And the question then is, consumers need to navigate a decision between choosing shorter loan terms with higher monthly repayments, difficult for some, versus longer terms with lower payments but higher overall costs. The point I'm trying to make is sometimes we have little choice in that respect.
I think sometimes people also don't understand that trade-off. So I think that there is a way that we can present information. And in fact, there's a lot of studies that have shown, I've actually been reading a study by the EU where they put different loan agreements in front of consumers. And depending on how the information was depicted, they made different choices. So I do think that we need to be more aware, and we need to be made very clear. Rather than you will only pay 1,000 rand a month, for example, it should say the total cost of this will be, you know, 50,000 versus 70,000. And so that people have it, that's the first number you see, rather than the monthly installments. I think there are ways of presenting information that makes the consumer more aware of the actual cost of it. So I think that is part of it. And then, yes, certainly we do sometimes have to make decisions around, okay, I understand this is going to cost me more in the long term, but right now this is my affordability. But then, Jeremy, it goes back to that point I said at the beginning, which is maybe if you're buying a home and you're a young person trying to get into the home market, I can understand that as a good reason. Mm. But to own a 30,000 Rand iPhone as opposed to maybe a 5,000 Rand one that you can buy and take a lot, now you're making decisions and choices that are not perhaps the most sensible.
And particularly when it comes to cell phones, because they are rapidly depreciating assets.
Completely. And I must tell you, I have actually bought my last cell phone secondhand, and it's going and it's absolutely fantastic and it works really well, but you can pick it up secondhand, you know, relatively for a relatively lower amount. So yes, they depreciate. There is literally no reason to go and buy an expensive phone. And I think one of the big things that creditors have done, or credit providers have done, is they've gone and made these lump sum big expenses look cheap. By turning them into a monthly installment. And I wondered, Jeremy, if you had to save for a phone, would you honestly go and draw 30,000 Rand out of your savings account and buy a phone with it? I don't think so. I think if you had the cash, you would probably say, even if you had the cash in the account, you would say, wow, that just feels like a lot of money. But when we turn it and we do these sort of fake economics with it and fake maths, we turn it into something that says, oh, well, it's only costing me this per month. And I think that is where credit providers have become very, very clever.
Yeah, Maya, you're also preaching to the converted here. I would be more than happy to keep using my 1994 Nokia, but no one's interested anymore. Do you think, Maya Fisher-French, as we start to approach a rates-cutting cycle now with the announcement yesterday, that consumer behavior might change in any way because there will be a little bit more liquidity?
I think for most people, this is just breathing space. I think they have literally been sort of at, you know, just at the precipice, you know, financially. So what I would like to see, obviously, and I hope for those people who have mortgages or even car finance, but certainly it's easier with mortgages, is that if they can afford to keep their repayments at the current rate, because that actually has a huge impact on their ability to pay off their home loans sooner. So especially, say, for example, you are somebody who took out a 30-year home loan because of affordability. If you can maintain the repayments at the current rate rather than dropping them with the, you know, as the interest rates cut, you can take off 4 years, you know, for example, off your mortgage. And I think those are some of the ways that we can use the rate cuts if we have a little bit of liquidity. But I think for other people, that little bit of extra liquidity is going to go to paying off short-term debt. People have really accumulated a huge amount of short-term debt over the last 2 years, as you know, as it's become harder and harder to make ends meet. Mm. So I'm hoping to see that people using that to really get rid of some of their debt.
But the prism is also being skewed slightly by the advent of the two-pot system.
Oh, the two-pot system. Yes. I think we are concerned, obviously, about how that money is being used. You know, I do know people who've come to me and they said, I cannot meet my debt repayments. Would it make sense to take my two-pot payment, you know, amounts? And I think there are people who genuinely, you know, I've used that to really pay off debt that perhaps was going to actually see them go into sort of legal action against credit provider, you know, by credit providers. And maybe there has been some of that. And I think there definitely has been some of that happening. But when I have heard people going off to renovate a kitchen, to take the family on holiday, and I, you know, obviously I'm deeply concerned about that. And I think we will see, and we know the retailers are expecting a little bit of a better Christmas because of it. So maybe the retailers and the shareholders and all the companies of the retailers will certainly be better off, but not necessarily the consumers.
Some really good advice there. Maya Fisher-French, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A 5-year legal battle involving the former chief executive of the National Health Laboratory Services, Joyce Mokgale, has finally come to a head. Mokgale was fired in 2019, you might recall, after a disciplinary hearing found her guilty of failing to fulfill her duties regarding 3 procurements totaling about 200 million rand. She then in turn lodged a case of unfair dismissal, but was denied and then ordered to pay the public entity 22 million rand in damages. I'm in conversation now with Professor Eric Buch, who's the chairperson of the board of the NHLS. Professor, welcome and thank you very much for joining me. Now, given the court's description of the NHLS under Mokgale and Zulu as the blind leading the blind, what specific changes have been implemented to enhance oversight?
Well, Jeremy, thanks for your interest in the case. This started 7 years ago, and so we've been on a journey of all kinds to deal with this, which includes digitizing a lot of our records so that pieces of pages don't disappear, and that you've got proper tracking, much tighter financial controls, and as a public entity, we have built up reserves which were at about 100 or 200, 300 million back then. We now have 6 billion roughly in the bank, and we've been able to do that while keeping our annual tariff increases for our services at below 5%. And you can only do that if you're managing things financially properly.
Or did the laboratory service find itself in this parlous state in the first place, though? It points to a lack of governance, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, I think you can question the governance, but and ask questions about the board. But, we went to the Special Investigation Unit of the Presidency, the SIU, and reported the matter, and they've investigated. Their report does not blame the board. The court has not blamed the board. The criminal case that Mokgali and others are facing has not pointed anything towards the board. In fact, the board has been complimented on its commitment to seeing this case through and its due diligence. The challenge we faced here is that, in our view, there was what was really a corrupt cabal working to defraud the board and to mislead the board and provide false information to the board. And, in the criminal matter linked to this, which also started this year, the former CEO, Mokgali, is charged, but also the legal manager, the supply chain manager, the facilities manager, and the chief financial officer would have been also one of the accused, except that he's, unfortunately for his family, he's passed away between then and now. So, when you have what seems to us to be a process of collusion by all of them to mislead the board, and it's quite difficult to pick it up.
That's my point, Professor. And in no way am I blaming the board, but it must raise issues about internal oversight mechanisms that were unable to detect the problem earlier.
Yes. It took us some months, not years, to detect it. The head of internal audit and risk was also dismissed for dereliction of duty and negligence. As well. So what we have now is an electronic system that records these items and flags them. So for example, in Mokgali's case, she had a certain level of delegation of authority, which was 10 million rand, where she could approve procurements if they were properly done. Above that, it had to come to the board. And we believe that these three procurements were not brought to the board for nefarious reasons, because it was pretty obvious that they had to. And now we've got a sort of a digital system that doesn't allow it. So we have put in place these kinds of measures.
And Professor, how does the service plan to recover the 22 million rand?
Well, we're going to take all legal measures to get the money. Mokgali had 1 million rand in her pension fund. We blocked that, probably about 5 years ago. And we will now go to the pension fund and claim that. And then we will use all measures to recover the remaining amounts from her and all her assets.
And you're confident, Professor, that the new leadership now has the skills and integrity to avoid a repeat of these issues again?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, now, subsequent to Mokgali's dismissal, Professor Shabir Mahdi acted for close to a year, and then we appointed Dr. Cammie Chetty, and she's just retired, and we've now just appointed Prof. Koleka Musana, and all of them are people of the highest integrity. Dr. Cammie Chetty was there through the bulk of this period together, and they have worked extremely hard to deal with a whole range of corruption, malfeasance, and irregularities, because the cases that are here in the media are the high-level cases. There have been it doesn't stop there. It trickles down through the organization, right. And they've taken it at great personal risk, really, to clean out the organization.
Well, one hopes the end of a shameful chapter. Professor Eric Buch, thank you very much indeed, Chairperson of the National Health Laboratory Service.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on our program today, scientists from the University of the Western Cape have joined an international mission to study Pluto. Using cutting-edge technology, they've captured a rare celestial event called an occultation, which could reveal new details about Pluto's atmosphere. With me now is Professor Nico Otte from the University of the Western Cape. Professor, what new insights are you hoping to gain then about the atmosphere from this recent event?
Yes. So we are trying to figure out about Pluto's atmosphere, whether it's freezing. Supposedly, you know, this Pluto goes around the sun every 200 and something years. We didn't have the technology to see how Pluto's atmosphere evolves with time as it goes farther away from the sun and the temperatures get colder and colder, the outer space. So we are trying to see, the theory is that the atmosphere will freeze out and will collapse onto the surface of Pluto. So this has never been observed, and these occultations provide such information. After many, many years, you know, it goes through, and then you have an evolution of what is happening in the atmosphere. And when Pluto passes over a star behind, far behind, then the starlight just diffracts onto the surface of Pluto. And this diffraction, which happens at the center of Pluto's shadow on Earth, that sudden flash provides information about the temperature and chemical composition of the atmosphere of Pluto. This is what we are aiming at, to look at that flash.
Professor, could you explain to me why it's crucial to study Pluto now, particularly as you've explained to me its atmosphere may be collapsing or freezing?
This is a beautiful question that you always ask me, and I've been thinking these interviews are good to think about how the public can understand this. First, I have a personal need for these kind of observations because I want to study how elements, particularly I am a nuclear physicist. I do a nuclear astrophysics, and recently we have a theory on how we see the same amount of gold, silver, platinum, heavy elements throughout the universe. We just published a paper in a very prestigious journal, the Oxford University Press, and we have a program at SALT, at the Southern Large Telescope, to study these metal poor stars where they have very few metal lines. You know, it's a very poor in abundance. You know, so when you don't understand something, in particular how elements are created in these stellar explosions, we want to go to the simplest case scenario, which are these metal poor stars. So by using this telescope, I want to gain more information because it works in the same way as the bigger telescopes. But with this one, we have the flexibility to go to these particular places where you can see the dead center of Pluto's shadow on Earth as it moves across Africa, and you are right there in Upington, just looking at the dead center of Pluto's shadows on Earth. But this is the same technology is used in both telescopes. I want to understand better the technology of studying these metal poor stars. But that's personally, myself. For you guys, for everyone else, you know, there's a bigger picture, obviously. NASA is not investing all this money to bring here, you know, Professor Orte's research agenda. So they come here because they want to understand. They want, the next big discovery will be life in other planets, right? It will be life anywhere. So we need to know. We need to understand how the atmosphere, because we're going to see the light from these occultations as well. That's how we are going to identify what is the composition of those planets, exoplanets far, far away. So we need to understand how these atmospheres behave at the low temperatures that they may be in those conditions, right? So it's very important for us to understand when we see this light, when we see this life or this light from these exoplanets, reflection of the light from other stars, and we understand what the composition is. If we have oxygen, then the chances to have life will be greater, right? And then we can zoom in and go to that particular planet and see whether life can be found. You know, these are the kind of things that we are investigating, the composition of the atmosphere of different planets by knowing Pluto, which is far away, and it's a big challenge, you know, but the next step is to go even farther, right? And trying to find out about life elsewhere.
Professor, that makes perfect sense. How far do you think we are from that big discovery of finding life on an exoplanet?
There's a lot of things happening. You know, now we have SKA, the Square Kilometer Array in South Africa. We have the Southern Large Telescope in Sutherland. So we have all the tools, and obviously, if we get NASA, we're sending probes and these spacecraft everywhere. And then I think we may be in a situation where we are discovering every day new exoplanets far away. There's a new planet in our closest star besides our sun. Alpha Centauri is 4.3 light years. You know, the light takes 4.3 years to reach to us. Or, you know, for us to send a signal, it will also take 4.3 years. So these are very beautiful things that humanity tries to find life somewhere, but we cannot say when. But people think, you know, people were always aiming to find life maybe tomorrow, you know, but it would take, you know, there are like hundreds of those planets out there that we have discovered, but we don't know about the composition. So all these techniques that we're developing here, or NASA is developing, because NASA is the funder of all these occultations, you know. So we are just helping them in developing this. But also we have a telescope here at UWC. It was donated by the University of Virginia. And then we can see more occultation next year. Maybe Pluto is passing by in Africa, in Southern Africa, and we'll be able to do the occultation again. And maybe this time, because last time there was a sudden wind that shook the telescope, and we very clear the flash, you know, the flash that provides this information. So we see whether the data is good. I think we are cleaning the data, but there will be another opportunities, and maybe next year, you know, and the year after, you know, we have all the tools. The university has provided also new funding, laptops and things for these NASA missions to support these NASA missions, right? So the University of the Western Cape is very, very strong about supporting this and figuring out about life elsewhere.
Professor Nico Othre from the University of the Western Cape, fascinating conversation and good luck. Nice talking to you today. And that is also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.